Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As it's Friday, it's time for our weekly media roundtable, where we connect you with journalists in a conversation about the coverage of major stories of the week. This morning, more evidence of just how deadly it is to be a reporter in Afghanistan. An Afghan police officer shot AP photographer Anya Niedringhaus to death and wounded her colleague, Kathy Gannon, as they were traveling with election workers. Afghans begin voting for a new president tomorrow, but with aid workers and election observers fleeing violence, how credible will this election be, and what might it mean for the U.S. pullout scheduled for the end of this year? In a moment, we're going to be joined by Jeremy Kelly. He's the Kabul-based correspondent for the Times of London. Also, here in this country, on Wednesday, there was a Supreme Court decision that could affect our elections. In its ruling in McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, the court struck down overall limits on campaign contributions. The decision means that a single donor will soon be able to contribute millions of dollars in limited contributions to political parties, candidates, and political action committees. So how big a deal is this decision, and is it likely to have an effect on the midterm elections in November? Paul Blumenthal, who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post, would be a great person to ask. Fortunately, he's on the line with us from Washington. Hey, Paul, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And the week actually began with the first major report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 7 years. The report's lead officer, biologist Chris Field, wrote, "We're now in an era where climate change isn't some kind of future hypothetical." And he said those of us who live here in California are in an area where, quote, impacts from climate change are already widespread and consequential. Mark Hertzgaard's reporting has long underlined the immediacy of climate change, and he says that the mainstream media are starting to get it. Mark is the environment correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of 6 books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, great to have you back on the show.
Good to be here, Matt.
So let's start, as we always do, by talking about good reporting from the week. And that's not to say good news, but journalism done well. Mark, let's start with you. Was there an example of some reporting this week that you thought, hey, now this is somebody really doing the job right?
Yes, 2 examples, in fact, on the IPCC report. If you're going to read one piece about this, everybody, look for Seth Borenstein's Associated Press dispatch, which ran in Huffington Post. It's the best piece on it. And then the big surprise was NBC Nightly News, which did an excellent piece with their environment correspondent, Ann Thompson, and it led the NBC Nightly News, and Brian Williams, as the anchor, gave a very informed and urgent introduction to just how important this new report is, and that is a very welcome shift from the general disregard that most of the media and television in particular has given to climate change news in the past.
So we're going to come back to talk about the IPCC report and media coverage of it, but just, you know, talking about that, the NBC report that you highlight, why do you think this report maybe broke through and got some attention that that it might not have in the past?
I think part of it is that the scientists themselves emphasize that this is about humans and it's about now. It's not about polar bears in the distant future. It's about the people of California, the people of Russia and Japan and everybody right now. I think that helped. And then the other thing is frankly, the criticism that the media organizations have gotten for neglecting this story in the past. And I think a third factor related to all of this is Hurricane Sandy. In November 2012, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, the de facto headquarters of the U.S. news media. And I think Hurricane Sandy brought the climate issue home to a lot of journalists and news executives who previously had not really taken it on board, had not really looked at it. And, of course, you know, when it finally happens to you yourself, that makes a big difference.
There's something about that. So Mark Hertzgaard giving kudos to the NBC Nightly News reporter Ann Thompson, as well as Seth Borenstein from the AP. As I say, we'll come back to talk about the climate change story later in the hour. But before that, Paul Blumenthal, I want to turn to you and say, you know, what did you see this week that impressed you?
Well, I think one article that really stood out for me was here where I work at the Huffington Post by David Wood, who had previously written a Pulitzer Prize-winning series on injuries suffered by veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And his piece this week is about the shooting at Fort Hood. And he has a recent series into sort of moral injury that a lot of returning veterans are having, and investigations by health experts into, you know, how the actions that they undertook in a war zone really affect their moral character and how they deal with that. And the article about Fort Hood relates to both that and also the fact that our understanding of PTSD is very limited, and there's been no signs of connection between PTSD and any kind of homicidal instincts, as seem to be implied sometimes in media coverage of these kind of mass shootings. And, you know, I think it really helps to look into how we have a very limited understanding of this psychologically damaging condition, and that we should be, you know, more careful in how we might stigmatize people who suffer from, you know, psychological issues.
Now, explain what you, when you say the PTSD, when you say, when you talk about moral injury, that's a concept I haven't heard about before. What's David Wood report about in this?
So he had a series that I think came out in the past few weeks about moral injury, and, you know, this is really about, you know, a wound to a person's moral foundation. You know, a lot of people who, you know, go to fight in a war zone have, you know, deep moral beliefs about who they are that really define them as a person, and in a war zone you're often confronted with having to break those beliefs, and it sort of undermines a person's sense of self when they come home to, you know, a normal environment, to have to consider what they did, that this isn't necessarily post-traumatic stress disorder or anything of that, but something that profoundly wounds them in how they think about themselves.
Well, thank you for that, Paul. It's David Wood's piece for the Huffington Post. We will post all of these articles and anything else that's recommended or referred to during today's roundtable at our website, yourcallradio.org. And I'm glad to say we have now on the line Jeremy Kelly with the Times of London, who is their Kabul correspondent. Jeremy, thank you for staying up and joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Great to have you with us. And I was just talking to Paul Blumenthal and Mark Hertzgard. As we do at the beginning of the program, we talk about journalism reporting that was done well this week, not necessarily reporting on happy or good news, which I know, is, at least in Afghanistan right now, is in short supply, but wondering if there was a piece of reporting or analysis this week that impressed you that you'd want to let people know about.
Well, I thought story in the New York Times today talking about President Karzai maneuvering for a sort of a role once he stands down following the presidential election tomorrow. It was a very interesting piece.
Talk a little bit about that, actually, because your most recent piece kind of focused on that as well, right? The role that Karzai might play in a future administration, regardless of who wins the elections that start tomorrow.
Well, it's pretty clear that President Karzai intends to have some role once he stands down. As your listeners, I'm sure, would know, he's constitutionally forbidden from standing for another five-year term. And as Afghans go to the polls tomorrow, I mean, this is an election that has been, in some ways, very much sort of guided by Mr. Karzai's hand. I mean, he's played a significant role in organising the tickets of many of the leading candidates. In fact, he's encouraged many of the candidates to, in fact, run. He's told several of them, or he urged several of them, to actually stand for election, and according to some of them, urged and told them that he would offer his support if they stood for president. Now, he said publicly all along that he wouldn't anoint a successor, and he hasn't done that. So he, in effect, sort of conned a couple of people into running for president. According to some Afghan officials, many Western diplomats here, this has been his way of, like, keeping options, like having a contested election that he can sort of, like, see how it plays out, and then gives him power once the election is run and won to sort of call in some favours. Now, like, not only will he seek a role, I mean, his new residence once he finishes as president will be inside the presidential grounds where he currently lives. last year he commissioned a new house for Murray's wife and three children, including a newborn daughter, will move into. So President Karzai is still going to be around and very much a key figure in Afghan politics. Now, the extent of this will possibly depend on who actually wins this election. Two of the three front runners he has a very good relationship with, like not always like perfect, but you know, a solid relationship. Another, Abdullah, the relationship is less sort of, well, not quite as warm as with the other two, but like even then, like he will be able to sort of position himself in, with regardless of who wins this election, to remain a key figure in Afghan politics.
So as someone who's observing these elections, and we'll get to the kind of question of just how credible they can be, given how dangerous it is and how election observers can't even be, you know, be safely in certain parts of the country. I mean, do Afghans have a real choice here, or is it just kind of, you know, small degrees of difference?
Well, I think Afghans really do have a choice. And this has been one of the more refreshing things of this election campaign compared with those past, that, like, there are three sort of distinct leading candidates with, like five other candidates still running live on the ballot. And Afghans really do have a choice on you know, who they're going to vote for. And, like, there's not a great deal of difference between those candidates, but there is a choice there, which was sort of lacking, the breadth of choice that has been lacking in elections past. And I think this is, like, added in to help sort of fuel and enthusiasm that for many of us have lived here for many years, haven't seen before. Like, there's been very good attendance at, like, public rallies. You know, there's, like, a lot of buzz on the street. Afghans are sort of seemingly embracing this concept, especially in the cities, obviously less so in the more remote and rural areas, which, of course, like, make up, like, the majority of the constituency. But, like, there's been increasing the sort of enthusiasm for democracy, and there's still a long way to go, obviously, but it's certainly an improvement on 2009 and like going back even to 2004.
So let me ask, I mean, reading about this, it's just remarkable. And this, you know, this past weekend, the staff members at the Independent Election Commission in Kabul, right? They were basically hiding in bunkers and safe rooms while the offices were being attacked. And this is in the capital, right? This isn't out somewhere in the, you know, in the countryside. How, you know, what kind of election can you carry out under those circumstances?
I'm having trouble hearing you, but I think you were talking about the election offices being attacked.
Yes.
In Kabul.
Yes.
These attacks, in some ways, especially in Kabul, rallied a lot of people to stand up and like to defy the Taliban and other insurgents, to say, no, we won't be sort of intimidated by these attacks, and we will exercise our rights. And I'm sure that those attacks will deter people from going to the polls tomorrow. But like equally, there's probably as many people who are more determined to go to the polls and like exercise their democratic right to vote tomorrow.
So let me ask, I know it's late there and we just have you for a short while, and I want to let Paul and Mark know if either of you have questions for Jeremy before we let him go. I welcome those. But I want to ask you about a story that was, you know, it's made global headlines this morning, and that is about the shooting to death of a reporter, a photographer, the AP, this morning, Anya Niedringhaus, and also wounded her colleague Kathy Gannon. They were traveling with election workers outside of the Capitol. And you know, it just really underlines, I mean, these, and obviously earlier this month, Swedish journalist Niels Horner was killed in kind of execution style. And for Afghan reporters, Sardar Ahmad, who's a prominent Afghan journalist, worked for AFP, was killed along with his wife and two of his three children. I mean, obviously this is just an ongoing story, but as someone who's been there for a while, what does it feel like, and how do you work under these circumstances?
Well, today's incident and, like, the killing of Sadar, the Afghan journalist that you mentioned, were like tragic and a real shock to especially the journalism community here in Kabul. Up until the start of this year, like most of us, like Afghan or Western journalists, have felt reasonably safe, like doing our jobs. Of course, there's the risk of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but being targeted was something that you never really thought of. And there's been a succession of incidents going back to an attack on a Lebanese restaurant in Kabul in January, which has shown that foreigners in particular are now very much in the sights of insurgents. Of course, it's worrying, and like many of the journalists here have been forced to reinvest their security. Like some have moved out of their houses and moved into more secure locations. Most of us realise that we have a job to do, and it is a dangerous sort of location, and you are very exposed, like doing your job on the streets. It will, events like these, not so much the one today, but the ones previous, are forcing people to reassess how they do their job, what long-term effect that has on covering this conflict remains to be seen. But it's very tragic and like has made us all reconsider how we go about our day-to-day work.
Jeremy Kelly is a correspondent for the Times of London. He's reporting from Kabul, where tomorrow Afghans will go to vote for a new president. And you are listening to the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Also with us on the line from Washington, Paul Blumenthal, who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post, and Mark Hertzgard, environment correspondent for The Nation magazine. Paul or Mark, before we let Jeremy go and then turn to other subjects, do you have any questions for him right now in Kabul?
I would simply say, Godspeed, Jeremy. It's whenever a journalist falls in the line of duty, I think all of us feel a solidarity with them. So I hope you stay safe. And I hope all the listeners remember that this is, what journalists do all over the world. It's not just in Afghanistan. Right here on the border of California and Mexico, there are many journalists dying covering the drug war there. And we do this because we believe in the role of the media in informing you, the public, about what's going on and being done in your name. So please support journalist organizations like the Committee to Protect Journalists, who help journalists in these situations.
Paul, anything you'd like to ask Jeremy before we say goodbye?
I'm just going to concur with that statement.
Well, maybe I'll just, speaking of what's done in our name, final question for you, Jeremy. This election and its relation or lack of relation to the U.S. troop withdrawal that's planned for the end of 2014, could it have an impact? Could it change the course of things between now and December 31st?
Well, I doubt it. All the presidential sort of candidates have pledged to sign the security pact that would allow foreign troops to remain past December 31. Remember, the relationship between Mr. Karzai and Washington is rather frosty, and I think Washington, obviously, in particular, is looking forward to the new president, where they can set the reset button on this relationship and plan towards sort of what they call an enduring presence past December 31, 2014.
Jeremy Kelly, thank you so much for joining us from Kabul. Good to have you with us, and have a good night.
Okay. Anytime. Thanks, Egon.
Take care. Jeremy Kelly is the Kabul-based correspondent for the Times of London. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. Also with us for the rest of the hour, Paul Blumenthal, who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post. We're going to be talking with Paul about the McCutcheon versus FEC commission that opened things up for even more money, big money in campaigns in this country. And also with us is Mark Hertzgard, who is environment correspondent for The Nation magazine, who has a lot to say about the coverage of the latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that came out earlier this week. If you'd like to join the conversation, particularly look for specific examples of reporting or analysis that you found valuable or that you'd like to critique. We just like to dig into something real and specific. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. talk, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Paul, I want to talk with you about this decision that came down on Wednesday, McCutchen versus FEC. It's generated a lot of reaction. And my first question is, were you surprised by it?
I was most definitely not surprised by this decision. This has been in the tea leaves all along. The Roberts Court has pretty much taken a hatchet to campaign finance regulation at every turn they get, often in small pieces. So, you know, before Citizens United, they had a case called Wisconsin Right to Life that began to chip away at corporate contributions to independent groups. Then they used that justification for Citizens United. Now, in this McCutchen versus FEC ruling, which has struck down a federal campaign contribution limit for the very first time since 1976, is relying on that Citizens United decision's assertion that the only valid concern for corruption that the government can have is bribery, the direct kind of quid pro quo, I'll give you money, you give me legislation or some kind of favor in return. And that, you know, corruption does not mean undue influence or access or any other thing aside from this just outright bribery. So it's a very limiting definition of corruption that has now been taken from the world of Citizens United and independent groups and being placed onto campaign contribution limits, which means going forward, it looks like a lot of other limits are bound to fall.
So break this down for us. So, I mean, if we're thinking about, say, what will happen in the midterm elections in November, how might this change the way wealthy individuals can spend their money? Just tell us what was possible, what was not possible that is now possible.
So the contribution limit that was struck down is an aggregate campaign contribution limit. So overall, prior to this ruling, a single wealthy individual could give about $123,000 in total to political candidates, party committees, and political action committees. That limit is now gone, which means that a donor can give maximum $5,200 checks to as many candidates as they want. In total, you know, the potential amount that a single donor could give in these limited contribution amounts is over $3 million, over $4 million, depending on how many committees they want to give to. And what's likely to happen this election cycle is that party leaders will create something called a joint fundraising committee, which allows somebody to bundle a large check to a number of committees and candidates. Just, you know, write a multi-million dollar check to these giant joint fundraising committees that will be created, and then it will be distributed out. But this will also provide an opportunity for someone like Speaker John Boehner or President Barack Obama or Harry Reid to go to a fundraiser and solicit a multi-million dollar check, which has been seen since McCain-Feingold and even other campaign finance reform bills have been passed as a, you know, a potential corrupting act, but the Supreme Court no longer sees it that way.
That's Paul Blumenthal, who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post. And he's talking about this McCutchen versus FEC decision that came down from the Supreme Court on Wednesday. Also with us on the Your Call Media Roundtable is Mark Hertzgard, environment correspondent for The Nation magazine. Definitely want to hear how Mark, as an environmental reporter, thinks about how this might affect legislation and policy around the environment, having yet more big money being able to go directly to two candidates or at least to party leaders. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this break.
There are many ways to join in our conversation today on Your Call here on KALW. On the phone, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Or you can drop us a line. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at the top of the hour from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And following that at 12 today, the Tavis Smiley Show.
Thank you. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. We podcast our program. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and that's also where past shows are archived. Coming up next week on Monday, we're going to have an open line to Moral Monday. That's the NAACP-led movement that is beginning a lot of attention as the linchpin of progressive organizing in North Carolina. It's pushed hard, back hard against an aggressive right-wing majority in the North Carolina State House. So we're going to find out about how it started, what tactics it uses, and to ask whether they can be used in other places, including here in California. Then on Tuesday, we're going to be speaking with the co-founders of Idle No More. Jessica Gordon and Nina Wilson were two of the people who helped spark a viral movement for justice among Canada's First Nations people last year. So they're coming here talking about the work that they do and how they can build bridges to social and environmental justice groups in the U.S. So you'll want to join that conversation. Really interesting people next week on Your Call. Today, it's our media roundtable. With us for the rest of the hour, Paul Blumenthal, money and politics correspondent for The Huffington Post, and Mark Hertzgard, environment correspondent for The Nation, and also author of 6 books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. So, Paul, one of the reactions, one of the talking points coming from party leaders is, hey, this FEC, this decision, the McCutcheon decision, is going to give more power to party leaders and less to individual candidates, and therefore that will lead to more moderation and more, you know, more comedy on Capitol Hill, I'm assuming is the what we're supposed to assume from that. Is there anything to that from your perspective?
I think that there is something to the fact that, you know, political parties will be able to raise somewhat more money. I think that there's a lot of untruth in the statements that, you know, the political parties right now are weak. You know, aside from the state parties, which have been suffering for funds, you know, the national party committees have been raising, you know, large amounts of money, sometimes at, you know, a pace that they weren't doing when they had soft money and could accept, you know, multimillion-dollar checks from corporations or wealthy individuals. So this will allow them, and particularly the Republican Party, because it relies more heavily on these wealthy maximum donors than the Democrats, to, you know, have more funds. I also think it will allow candidates to raise more money. Some people have been saying that, you know, this will steer money away from outside groups and super PACs, but I really just I don't see that happening at all. People like the Koch brothers have their own political apparatus because they have their own agenda, which sometimes dovetails with the Republican Party, and they want their influence to continue. You know, they're not big into giving direct campaign contributions. They're more into building up their own political and lobbying apparatus that they can control directly, something that Citizens United allowed. And so I don't really see it affecting that. You also have a group like the Club for Growth, which you know, has been fighting the Republican Party and supporting these Tea Party candidates, and they do both outside spending, and they also direct a lot of these limited campaign contributions that now, because of the McCutcheon ruling, they'll be able to direct more of those to their candidates. So, I mean, there are destabilizing efforts and there are stabilizing efforts for the political parties. At the same time, I think it's a, you know, there are two conversations going on here. One is, will politics become more corrupt? Will people be able to buy policies easier? And, you know, will this make it more, create more comedy on Capitol Hill? And, you know, I think maybe we have to decide which one of those conversations is more important to have.
Actually, speaking of the Koch brothers' agenda, certainly fighting back against policies that might address climate change is part of their larger agenda. And so, Mark Hertzgard, just to bring you in, obviously, Paul, you know, his beat is money and politics. Yours is the environment. But how would you approach this story from the perspective of people who, you know, care about the future of the planet?
You mentioned the Koch brothers. They're, of course, you know, the big players in this regard now, but also ExxonMobil. You know, there is no industry that is richer than the oil industry. It is the, Bill McKibben has pointed out, it's the richest business enterprise in all human history. So if we are now, through the Supreme Court decision, further opening the door for money to buy results in Washington, there's nobody who's going to take, who has the opportunity and the wherewithal to take advantage of that more than the oil and gas industry. And I guess my question to Paul is that how would he, how does he see this new Supreme Court decision
affecting the calculations of not just the Koch brothers, but, you know, the big boys at ExxonMobil and the others. They've had a pretty open field so far. Will this make a major difference in how big oil looks at buying political results in Washington, or will it be more incremental?
Well, I think that, you know, it'll be somewhat more incremental, at least at first. You know, what the decision allows basically would be for, you know, the CEO of ExxonMobil could now be pressed by party leaders in the Republican Party to, you know, to give multiple large contributions, $5,000, to as many candidates as they want. So, you know, there's the ability of party leaders and candidates to sort of put the screws to these donors and say, like, you don't have an aggregate limit anymore as an excuse to not give anymore. And so these CEOs will now have an opportunity to have, you know, influence and access, which the Supreme Court says is not a corrupting concern, with even more members of Congress, and more doors will open for them, more conversations will be had.
Those CEOs would be giving ExxonMobil corporate money, or their own personal money?
So the decision does not affect in any way direct corporate contributions to candidates, which are still banned. So this would be their own money from their own pockets, which are already pretty large.
Yeah.
Paul, I just want to jump in. So this decision this week, so explain, because I know you've read it, you've dug into it. What's the rationale for limits on donations to a particular candidate, as something, say, hey, you can't do that. You can't have unlimited donations to a particular candidate, but not to their aggregate giving. I mean, do you think it's likely that given the court as it is, those limits are ultimately going to go away as well?
So the justification that Roberts gives in his decision is that what we call the base limits, which is the $5,200 that a candidate can accept from one individual donor from their own personal money, provides a rationale to prevent a kind of quid pro quo corruption. However, the very limiting definition of corruption that has now been adopted from Citizens United into the realm of campaign contribution limits poses pretty much an existential threat to, I think, any campaign contribution limit, even though in the McCutcheon decision, Roberts says, oh, this will not affect the soft money ban on political parties from accepting million-dollar checks, or this will not affect, you know, the base limits. I think that is just a deflection of what's to come in the future, and we're definitely going to see future cases that challenge quite a number of limits that we already have. I think the McCain-Feingold ban on soft money contributions is likely to go, considering that the Supreme Court upheld those bans based on a statement that they created a corrupting concern related to access and influence and not quid pro quo corruption. So if the court wants to revisit that decision with this new corruption standard, I can't see why they would not strike down the heart of the McCain-Feingold law.
That's Paul Blumenthal, money and politics reporter for the Huffington Post, talking about the implications of this week's McCutcheon decision by the Supreme Court. Also with us, Mark Hertzgard, environment correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of 6 books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. And I want to welcome in a listener, Fred in Watsonville, who's called up. So welcome, Fred.
Wanted to point out what I thought was a really wonderful report of a kind that one very seldom hears on Latino USA this week. There's a story by a reporter named Jennifer Dunn, D-U-N-N, called Colombian Villagers Return Home, about an elderly group of folks who are trying to go back to their coffee-growing village after having been forced out by the Civil War. And it touches on urban versus rural, it touches on the old and the young, on the effects of the drug war. It's just a multifaceted, beautifully told story that I would really urge people to go and listen to.
Thank you so much, Fred, for that recommendation. I heard that report by Jennifer Dunn on Latino USA about, it's kind of talking about the aftermath of Civil War and kind of how people put put lives back together again, go back to their homes, which is something we rarely get. Kind of the, you know, there's often talk about when something is really hot. And of course, I mean, here in the United States, I have to say coverage of Latin America, period, is thin on the ground, let alone that kind of follow-up coverage. Mark or Paul, any thoughts about that?
Nothing here.
That's quite all right. Fred, thank you so much for that. And we will post a link to that report at yourcallradio.org. Mark, I want to shift gears, talk about another big story this week. And this was from the very beginning of the week. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out with a major report. Am I right? This is kind of their first big report in 7 years, right?
Second installment of the first big report in 7 years. The IPCC is divided into three working groups: the science group, the impacts group, and the mitigation group, as in what do we do about it. And the science group has already issued their report, and so what we got this week was the second installment on what the science means, what the impacts will be for humans and ecosystems around the world, and then next month, or I should say later this month, rather, we'll be getting the third installment of this report. And these reports, of course, go back to 1990, which is when the IPCC was first installed and issued its first report. This is the fifth, the official name is the fifth assessment report on climate change. And what makes this one different, really, is that the scientists are at least trying to be more plain-spoken. I don't recommend anybody who's not a specialist to try and read that report. It's pretty still opaque scientific language. And so I and other reporters have tried to unpack it a bit. I have a piece in The Nation and also one running in Daily Beast this weekend. As I said before, a terrific piece at the Associated Press that Huffington Post posted by Seth Borenstein, who's always worth reading on this. And it's interesting, since this is a media discussion, Seth told me, actually, there were only five U.S.-based reporters sent to Japan to report on this study, this report in Yokohama, Japan. It was the AP, the New York Times, the Guardian, somebody from The Economist, and somebody from the BBC. You know, this is an example of what happens when news budgets are slashed. It's harder and harder to get people there on the ground to actually, you know, talk to the people who are issuing the report and give all of us the information we need to know. There's arguably no topic where news coverage is more important than climate change. And so I really urge people to tune in to these reports and look at what it is telling all of us, because the basic takeaway is it started and the worst is still to come, but we can still prevent the very worst of impacts if we act now.
So may I ask you, because I think a lot of people, they hear UN, IPCC, their eyes kind of glaze over. And you're making a point that these scientists, these people are trying to really kind of at least having some kind of top line messages that can get through in the media so people will hear them in a way they may not have before. But why does an announcement like this end up happening, not say at UN headquarters in New York?
Oh, I think that just has to do with, you know, protocol within the UN, and every country has to be allowed to host this or that gathering so that they all get their bread buttered. You know, in later this month, the next announcement is going to be in Berlin. So it goes around in different cities around the world. I wouldn't read too much into that.
No, I guess I just kind of think about what would have made it so that, hey, every reporter on Earth shows up. There's certain cities where every, you know, where reporters are thicker on the ground, and that would certainly be one of them. So talk about what were those kind of top line messages, and what were the examples of climate change coming home now, not as something happening in the Arctic or in certain kind of remote places, but, you know, in places that really matter to folks who actually might be able to make decisions to change the course we're on.
Yes, they talk quite a bit actually about California. In general, the three biggest impacts that they're focusing on in this report are what they call the, quote, breakdown of food systems, which essentially means there's going to be lower crop yields, especially for wheat and corn. We're already seeing wheat and corn yields going down, and they will be further diminished as the years go on. Of course, all other things being equal, if there's less food being produced and more mouths needing food, you're going to see prices go up. And it's usually
That is what causes hunger, by the way. It's not an absolute shortage of food, but rather because there's less of it, the prices go up and poor people can't afford it. And the knock-on effect of that, that was also highlighted in this IPCC report, is that we could see much more social strife and political unrest. You'll remember, Matt, that almost five years ago now, in 2008, there were food riots in 12 countries when food prices suddenly skyrocketed around the world, and you almost had governments fall. And the IPCC is now putting together these kinds of impacts and saying, as the crop yields go down, this is the danger that we could see, much more unrest. Also, by the way, from climate refugees, a phrase that is now entering the mainstream of climate discussion, because the other big thing that they're talking about is that there's going to be we're now locked into an increase in coastal flooding, especially in Asia, in countries like Bangladesh, where the New York Times, by the way, had a very good story about a week ago on the impacts that rising sea levels are already having in southern Bangladesh, a place where I've reported from as well. And because the land is so flat there, as the sea is rising, it's basically poisoning the soil with salt. And so, because the salt water is encroaching further inland, and that makes it harder and harder for people to grow their rice and vegetables and stay alive. So these are the kinds of impacts that they're trying to get people to focus on. And I think in general, the media reporting that was done on this did a pretty good job of conveying that it's here, it's now, this is not speculation. And again, I mentioned that NBC Nightly News story because there was none of that false balance that has so distorted media coverage of climate change in the past, where they say, well, some scientists say yes and some scientists say no. No, it was very clear, this is the deal, and we've got to get ready because it's coming.
Mark, I want to bring in a caller who's called into the program at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK if you want to join the conversation here on the Friday Media Roundtable. We welcome you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. William in Belvedere, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to go back to the political donation discussion that
Sure.
you had before. I'm wondering whether the guest perspective, there's a concept of the overwhelming importance of political donations as being a self-evident truth. And I'm wondering whether, rather than a self-evident truth, it's a paper tiger. By that I mean that when I think about what causes me to vote for one candidate or another, and I think about my friends, what causes them to vote for one candidate or another, whether there have been 10 commercials for one and 2 for the other, that has nothing to do with it. We're aware of what the candidates represent in terms of their ideas. And so I'm wondering to whom all of this money is talking.
Paul Blumenthal?
Well, you know, studies pretty much show that a lot of the political advertising on television is targeted at, low information voters, people who make up their minds in, the remaining weeks before an election. And, a lot of it is targeted towards the media to get media coverage of their advertisements as well. There is a possibility that sometime in the sort of near future, these kind of television advertisements will fall slightly as more people gravitate towards the internet, where you have, far more options to avoid ever seeing a commercial. And I mean, we have already seen some kind of efforts by political campaigns and television providers to, try to get these ads before people who are trying to circumvent the normal television watching experience. You have DirecTV and Dish TV have entered into an agreement to provide political campaigns the opportunity to run advertisements during recorded programs. So if you record a program, you can fast forward through the commercials, but they're providing a service that for these political ads will prevent people from fast forwarding through their commercials.
Well, that's something to look forward to. we can look forward to that. But I think it does really raise the question. I think of the two of you, really good journalist. You dig in, you get the information, you analyze things, and not just by looking at the press release. You go beyond that. But when we think about these, think about elections, people who are often deciding them are these folks who you, Paul, call low information voters. How do you think about getting the message about what you really see going on to people beyond those who are, you know, taking their time in the morning to look at the Huffington Post website or who subscribe to The Nation? This is obviously a small subset of a subset of engaged people.
They always say you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Can you make him read?
Or read, yeah. You know, the reality is, I think Paul's using a very polite term for low-information voters. The reason, you know, the caller's correct. Maybe those ads don't work on that caller. But these parties spend that money because it delivers results. And so, you know, you've got to... there's a certain minimum level of engagement that can be expected, it seems to me, from a citizen in a democracy, and you're either serious about it or you're not. And, you know, we can't just blame the big money people for this. There's also a certain amount of blame that rests with the American people.
Paul?
I'm not going to completely disagree with that. I do think that a lot of people live incredibly busy lives, and I agree that, you know, people need to hold up their end of the bargain as being citizens of a democracy and trying to pay attention to this. But I also don't fault people who, you know, are sort of being crushed under this current economic inequality situation that we have going on, where they have to work two jobs and still get food stamps and, you know, try to figure out how to raise their kids in a really difficult environment, especially where you have corporate interests pushing to, you know, reduce benefits that they can get, reduce their health care, and, you know, cut the amount of money that they earn at these already low-paying jobs. So, I mean, it's tough out there for a lot of people to also have to, you know, stay up with the news, which, you know, is, you know, on a sort of rapidly increasing speed cycle right now, thanks to the internet and Twitter and cable television. I mean, I'd also add a point that was made earlier about the cutting of, you know, reporting funds and staff and budgets. Is a lot of local newspapers and local reporting outlets have basically had to shut down because of the lack of funds and lack of advertising funds. And I think that really does a disservice to, you know, people throughout the country who rely on their local paper to get news.
I want to agree with what Paul said, Matt. I didn't mean to be seen as criticizing people who are having a hard time. And I would just add that this is part of the reason that public media, public radio, public television is so important, because you can rely on getting good, solid information, and you don't have to listen through all those ads.
Well, I of course agree with that. But Margo and I just kind of turn back to the... So, we talk about kind of how political campaigns obviously are targeting a certain set of voters. But, in the climate change debate, whether it's corporate-backed advertising around climate, greenwashing kind of stuff, or it's, you know, the attempt of groups like 350.org to kind of change the conversation through messages that maybe, you know, that are more in the kind of soundbite bits of information, change people's perspective kind of stuff. Just talk about how you've seen those efforts on both sides of that and how, you know, the role of kind of money coming in on either side has played in making those messages possible or making them not get through.
Sure. Very quickly, the ExxonMobil and the rest of the big oil lobby, look, they have used millions and millions and millions of dollars in advertising and lobbying expenditures basically to try to discredit climate science, to confuse the public, and to confuse the media. And unfortunately, the media has, until quite recently, been pretty shameful on this story of climate change. They've really been quite gullible into saying, oh, there's scientists on both sides. So that has, and that's been well documented, that the big oil forces use that. I think on the environmental side, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned 350.org. Bill McKibben, who, of course, is a longtime journalist who founded that group, he, I think, has realized that you've got to be more effective as a public communicator than environmental groups traditionally have been. And that's why he chose the Keystone Pipeline as a focus of activism. By the way, he did so in the face of criticism from most mainstream environmental organizations based in Washington, who said, no, let's not do that. Let's keep our focus broad, and what if we lose, and so forth and so on. And I think McKibben understood a basic fact about the media politics, which is that you've got to get people's attention focused on something that is tangible, that is real, like a pipeline, rather than something that is abstract, like the future of the planet in the year 2050. And so I think in that regard, they've been quite effective at 350 in getting media attention, including through the civil disobedience and getting arrested at the White House and creating visually friendly but powerful messages. And so even though they don't have the millions of dollars that ExxonMobil does, they've really put Keystone on the map now. They've made it the defining climate decision of Barack Obama's presidency, and that's going to be coming in the next few weeks. So you want to keep an eye out for where Obama eventually lands on that.
One last question to you, Paul. Speaking of the future, what are you going to be working on here? What are you looking for from you on Huffington Post?
Well, you know, I'm going to continue to follow up on this court decision and what it means for the future, you know, which donors are likely to benefit from it. You know, I have a piece coming probably on Monday with one of my coworkers here, Ryan Riley, who covers the Department of Justice and the court, about how, you know, Roberts in the McCutcheon ruling essentially says that, you know, there are bribery statutes and fraud statutes that, you know, corrupt officials can be charged under. And, you know, some of these limits aren't necessary because of that, but that there's this whole apparatus that protects congressional lawmakers from giving over their documents to these investigators that have already stymied numerous investigations into federal officials.
Well, Paul Blumenthal, we will look forward to that reporting and other work from you in the Huffington Post. He is the money and politics reporter there. And Mark Hertzgard, longtime reporter on the Environment, environment correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of Hot, as well as other books. Thank you so much for both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We will leave it there, and thank you for listening. What can we learn from Moral Monday? On the next Your Call, we'll talk to leaders of the NAACP-led protests in North Carolina that are spawning similar efforts nationwide. In February, more than 80,000 people joined a historic march at the state capitol in Raleigh to oppose cuts to health care and education and threats to voting rights. What tactics and messages have helped Moral Monday grow? And how could it work in California and elsewhere? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.